This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuhi. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Protests against Kenya's Electoral Commission took place in four cities Monday, with local media reporting that at least three demonstrators were killed in western Kenya.
That's VOA's Jill Craig reporting from Nairobi. Details next.
Also today is the start of the World Humanitarian Summit in Istanbul, Turkey, and Nigeria's central bank governors are meeting amid a gloomy financial outlook for Africa's largest economy.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, protest against Kenya's Electoral Commission took place in three cities today, while police used tear gas to prevent demonstrators from marching in Nairobi. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
Riot police formed a line around Kenya's Electoral Commission headquarters Monday, waiting much of the afternoon armed with tear gas, water cannons, and tanks to deter demonstrators arriving for the now weekly protests against the commission. The protesters never reached the compound because police used tear gas and water cannons to disperse about 100 demonstrators before they could get close. Protesters were able to march against offices of the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, or IEBC, in the cities of Mombasa, Kakamega, and Kisumu. A reporter for the Standard newspaper, Philip Orwa, told VOA that one demonstrator in Kisumu was killed and four others hospitalized. There were conflicting reports on whether the deceased protester was shot or trampled to death. Local media also reported two fatalities in Siaya, a town northwest of Kisumu. Asa Inyakundi is a lawyer whose office is located near the Electoral Commission headquarters in Nairobi.
Today it wasn't as intense as it was before. I think what the police seem to have done, they were under instructions not to let people gather in big groups or in any groups at all. So I think in that sense, they were able to thwart any big groups and therefore the capacity to demonstrate.
Many bystanders agreed that the police acted more professionally this week than last, when photos and videos of riot police clubbing and kicking protesters were shared widely on social media and sparked outrage. The protesters, most of whom are supporters of the opposition CORD coalition, say the IEBC must be disbanded ahead of next year's national elections. The opposition says the IEBC favors the ruling Jubilee coalition. The opposition has held protests on four of the past five Mondays and has vowed to continue until the government engages in meaningful dialogue about the electoral process. Rufus Magaga is a CORD supporter and demonstrator.
With IEBC, we see the elections will not be credible. The results will be doctored and all that. Yes, they'll favor the current government.
But Inyakundi warns that these protests do not represent the opinions of the entire electorate.
I believe that what you're seeing now is just partisan politics. There is a whole group of Kenyans who do not agree with this.
Kenya is scheduled to hold presidential and parliamentary elections in August 2017. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Today is the start of the World Humanitarian Summit in Istanbul, Turkey. The two-day meeting brings together representatives of government, UN agencies, and non-governmental organizations involved in relief efforts. They will discuss ways of improving the financing and delivery of aid to 125 million people in need of emergency assistance, including refugees and internally displaced people. Nina Nepesova is the UN representative for humanitarian and emergency affairs for World Vision International. Reporter William Eagle asked her what are some of the problems of the system for delivering relief that need to be addressed.
Well, I think there are a couple of issues that we see today with the humanitarian system that could definitely be improved. One of the issues, of course, is we're facing massive shortfalls in funding. The majority of funding today goes to conflict-affected situations and protracted crises. In fact, up to 80% of funding goes there, these kind of situations don't get resolved overnight. So we're looking at a change to humanitarian financing that requires us to look at multi-year timeframes in order to address humanitarian issues that really last for years. So that's probably a really big piece of what we're trying to address. The other piece from World Vision's perspective is trying to bridge what is being dubbed as the humanitarian development divide. World Vision is a multi-mandated organization, so we very much address humanitarian issues, development issues, advocacy, and peace building. So what we're trying to bring to the World Humanitarian Summit as an organization, as part of our commitment, is a way to address that. What we are proposing, for example, in our own programming, is that we will dedicate up to 20% of our development funding to be released when our national affiliates require it to respond to humanitarian crises as they arise, and thereby try and protect the development gains that we have already made. This is currently not something, for example, that you would hear from a regular government donor. And this is kind of the change that we're looking for from the system as a whole. But first and foremost, as World Vision, we're stepping out and making this a commitment that we're prepared to make as an organization.
Well, what's another example of where you might see a divide between the development and humanitarian partners?
I think one of the other areas that we often see is the kind of commitments to system strengthening, for example, on child protection issues or issues of health. So what we see as humanitarian industry goes in and we provide short-term interventions, what we're trying to do as World Vision is to try and link humanitarian interventions to longer-term development progress. So one of the examples that we're also going to be proposing that we're committing to is delivering up to 50% of our humanitarian assistance through a cash first approach by the year 2020, allowing us to really bridge humanitarian safety nets that are quite short-term that we can provide through cash assistance to longer-term safety nets that are linked to protection systems that really support children and families in the longer term.
One prominent NGO, Doctors Without Borders, pulled out of the summit. It said that it was not confident that any agreements at the summit would be concrete. What is your reaction to that? Are you more confident that there will be some sort of concrete action coming out of the summit and that the summit will not simply be a talk shop?
There will be several things that are going to be launched at the summit. So, for example, the Global Alliance for Urban Crises, or, for example, the Global Alliance for Humanitarian Innovation. So these are quite concrete pieces that will be taken forward in a very specific way. There are actionable steps that have been put in place and roadmaps on how people who are joining these alliances will take this forward, and World Vision is a party to both. There are other aspects that are less clear, this has a lot to do also with the nature of the summit itself. This is not a governmentally led process, as many UN processes are, and this has been, from my understanding, from the very outset, quite purposeful in order to ensure that all humanitarian actors can come to the table and make their own commitments. As a result, there is no negotiated document, for example, for countries to sign, which is the normal UN process of negotiation at summits like these. So it is a little bit unclear, and we're hoping to get more clarity on what kind of accountability is going to be put in place following the summit. Of course, we're hoping that the summit outcomes will be strong, that we will walk away feeling that not just us, but also the rest of the humanitarian community has come together and really put some proposals on the table. However, I think that what's really important and what will really matter is an accountability framework that could be put in place for us to monitor how the commitments that are going to be made at the summit are implemented, and indeed a roadmap of how we're going to be going forward in terms of humanitarian response down the line.
That was Dina Nepisova of World Vision International. She was speaking with reporter William Eagle.
Well, the World Humanitarian Summit held a session today on the migrants and refugee crisis. UN Deputy Secretary General Jan Eliasson was the keynote speaker. He says there are two major trends regarding people leaving their countries.
One is the trend on displaced people, refugees, and internally displaced people, 60 million, 20 million refugees across borders, 40 inside countries. But then, of course, there is 244 million migrants out there, people who work and live abroad in places where they are not born.
He expects those figures to increase as a natural consequence of globalization and change.
We have to make sure that we present a narrative which corresponds to the realities, namely that migrants are important for economic growth. Migrants are important for population growth. Migrants are absolutely crucial for development, with the importance of remittances for development, maybe two or three times the size of all official development assistance.
The UN official also spoke on the importance of diversity.
I think also we need to stand up for the beauty of diversity in our societies, which is threatened from so many directions right now, dividing us into different categories, whether are religious or ethnic. This is why the meeting of this World Humanitarian Summit is so important. But I would also say, as you said, Mr. Moderator, it's a bridge to the next very important international meeting, namely the meeting on the 19th of September in New York on migration and refugees, on large movements of migrants and refugees. We will probably have more than 100 heads of state and government in on the 19th of September, the day before the general debate. And we took the step, some say even courageously, to bring in together in this discussion the issues related to refugees and the issues related to migrants. I know there is a different legal background in dealing with them, these two categories, but there are so many points that bring them together. And even a blurred line between the two. If you look at people forced to flee from droughts and horrible natural disasters, you don't quite know in which category they belong. And when I hear people leaving Syria, they leave because of the war, but so many leave also because the children don't get an education.
That was UN Deputy Secretary General Jan Eliasson speaking today at the World Humanitarian Summit in Istanbul.
Politicians, world leaders, and NGOs at the first World Humanitarian Summit are debating how to deal with global crises that have been made worse by war, climate change, and natural disasters. Many of those problems are in Africa. VOA's Nuria Tesson files from Istanbul.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon opened the summit in Istanbul by calling on world leaders to commit to improving humanitarian responses to crises. He said they should seize this opportunity and become agents of change. Banak Daywal, Director General of Disaster Management at South Sudan's Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs, is one of the delegates taking part in the meetings.
The agenda is colorful, but the worry that will it be put into action? We have attended so many conferences on humanity, but nevertheless, no concrete, no tangible actions have been taken by the world leaders and by the humanitarian community. And this summit should commit itself to ensure that there are sustainable actions that will improve the life of the needy people.
The agenda is crowded with competing crises: Middle East wars, climate disasters, massive refugee flows, increasing shortages of resources for the rapidly growing needs. But the Istanbul conference is likely to be dominated by concerns about the Syria conflict and the hundreds of thousands of asylum seekers who have arrived in Europe in the past 2 years. As a result, some fear that Africa, which is struggling with its own wars and disasters, could be lower on the agenda. Well, expresses his concerns.
The reason for our worry is that in Africa we expect aid from outside. This drought which is happening now in Ethiopia may affect South Sudan. We expect the African countries to be at the front line. I know that there are other priorities. Today is drought, tomorrow is war, is conflict, as you know, and then next day it could be a natural disaster. So our hope is that we learn from this summit. As we go back home, we should sit down and develop policies that will make real change in the life of the people.
In southern Africa alone, an estimated 31.6 million people are short of food and need assistance because of drought. This number is expected to climb to around 49 million by the end of this year and will require a lot more aid. With increasing financial humanitarian demands, today's meeting ended with the launch of the Grand Bargain, a plan to reduce the $15 billion funding gap between the needs of the humanitarian community and the resources available. For Voice of America, this is Nuria Tesson in Istanbul.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Greek authorities once again have announced they will evacuate the large makeshift migrant and refugee camp at the Macedonian border. The evacuation is scheduled to begin tomorrow. There are more than 8,000 people at the camp at Idomeni. Conditions there are often unsafe and unsanitary. But many have refused to leave, hoping that Macedonia would reopen the border. That would clear the way to the Balkans' route to Europe. Macedonia, however, says it will not reopen the border crossing. Reporter Mariama Karakulaki is in Idomeni. She spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about the planned evacuation.
It was reported on several Greek media that they were bringing extra riot police from Athens in Idomeni, specifically for this purpose, to evacuate the camp, but in a peaceful way. They have a strategy to start evacuating the train lines and then the rest of the camp, but it's going to take place in several days. So it's not going to happen today. They will not going to evacuate all the refugees from here today, but it's going to take quite a few days.
Of course, the Greek authorities have said this before, that they plan to evacuate the camp and then never did. Do you think this is the real thing this time?
This time, yes, I think it's the real thing. There are more checks on the way to Idomeni. There are more official reports, so I think this time it's going to happen. And the fact that they started asking journalists to leave the camp is a sign that it's going to be evacuated, because what they do is to send journalists out and they start the evacuation early in the morning. So everyone is expecting evacuation, even the aid workers are expecting a peaceful evacuation.
When they send the journalists outside of the camp, how far away are you from seeing what's going on in the camp?
Maybe 5 kilometers. We do not see anything.
So if there are any problems, you will not be able to see it happening?
No.
Where does the government plan to take these migrants and refugees?
Well, the past few days, there are more and more camps that are supposedly ready. So they will be taking refugees to these places. And to be honest, it's some kind of the right thing to do, because the demand is not sustainable. People cannot apply for asylum or do anything. So if the conditions at the new camps are better, then I think that people are going to be better there.
Any idea where these new camps are?
Most of them are in Thessaloniki from what I've seen, but they're in the mainland all over Greece.
That's reporter Mariana Karakulaki from the Greek-Macedonian border. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. In other migrant-related news, the Associated Press reports Libya has given the EU permission to train its coast guard. EU officials hope the move will help restrict the flow of migrants to Europe. The majority of migrants and refugees heading to Europe leave from Libyan ports with the help of human smugglers. Yesterday, the Libyan Coast Guard reportedly intercepted boats carrying nearly 900 migrants heading to Europe.
Nigeria's central bank governors are meeting amid a gloomy financial outlook for Africa's largest economy. Numbers released last week show the country's economy shrinking. Economists blame a shortage of fuel, persistent power outages, and a fall in the production of Nigeria's top moneymaker, oil. Christine reports from Lagos.
Nigeria is heading for a recession. That's what analysts say after the National Bureau of Statistics announced the economy contracted by about 0.4% in the first quarter of this year. Africa economist at London-based Capital Economics, John Ashbourne, said a shortage of fuel and a shortage of dollars to pay for imported goods stymied economic growth. He doesn't expect the second quarter to be much better.
It's very, very likely the economy will shrink again in this quarter, and then we're in a recession.
Oil is Nigeria's top export and the primary funder of the government's budget. The global drop in the price of crude has cut revenue and harmed the economy. Also, oil production has dropped by 500,000 barrels per day because militants blew up several key pipelines in the oil-producing Niger Delta region. Ashburn says the government hasn't helped things by imposing controls on foreign exchange, leading to a shortage of dollars in the country. The shortage of dollars has ripple effects, including the shortage of gasoline, because Nigeria imports most of its fuel. Growth in manufacturing also shrunk in the first quarter. Ashburn said manufacturers who rely on imported components can't get them.
One of the reasons why a lot of manufacturing firms did really badly, food processing and so on, was that it was hard for them to buy inputs like glass to put tomato paste into.
Many have called on the central bank to devalue the currency in order to spur growth and end the shortage of dollars. President Muhammadu Buhari has said he's against doing that. It remains to be seen if central bank officials will take any action after they conclude their meeting in Abuja tomorrow. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
South Africa's chief prosecutor says he will appeal a court order to review and possibly reinstate nearly 800 corruption charges against President Jacob Zuma. The legal decision is not without political fallout. VOA's Anita Powell explains from Johannesburg.
South Africa's top prosecutor says he'll challenge the order from the High Court to reopen a 2007 case against President Jacob Zuma for 783 charges of fraud, corruption, and racketeering. That decision amounts to support for the embattled president. Zuma is facing an increasingly raucous parliament, harsh media criticism, and sliding popularity ratings amid various scandals. National Prosecuting Authority head Sean Abrams said the court does not have the authority to tell prosecutors which cases to pursue. Abrams announced the decision Monday, but not before he delivered a 30-minute monologue in which he discussed the criticism he has faced from media, his own professional backstory, his thought process, his constitutional obligations, the depiction of his bushy eyebrows in political cartoons, and the fact that this was a difficult decision to make.
In the present matter concerning President Zuma, whatever decision I make will no doubt elicit criticism from some or other quarters. No decision will please all of the people. Yet, it is not in my job to seek to please anybody or make popular decisions, but only to act in terms of the principles and policy in accordance with my constitutional and statutory duties.
The court case is intimately linked to Zuma's rise to power. The charges date back to a 1999 arms deal. They were originally filed in 2007 and dropped just weeks before the 2009 national election. That decision effectively cleared the way for him to be elected president. The opposition Democratic Alliance asked the courts to review the decision to drop the charges. And last month, a panel of judges on the Pretoria High Court unanimously ruled that the case should proceed. The opposition criticized Abrams' decision Monday to appeal as a delaying tactic to shield Zuma. But political analysts say Zuma will soon face the real trial of any politician, the polls. The nation holds local elections in August, and analysts predict that Zuma's sliding popularity will hurt the ruling ANC. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Then tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Keith Holmes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.